People don't understand. I've seen it myself many, many, many times. Prime example, Paul Ingle, right? Paul Ingle was on diuretics, heavy, heavy diuretics, Kevin, right?
Yeah.
And he'd been fined by the British Boxing Board and Control, so they knew what he was doing, right? And he ended up the Yorkshire Hunter, great fighter. My brother was ringside when they carried him out on the stretcher. My brother said it was heartbreaking. He was working for the Birmingham guy, Man Commercial Protection, Ian McAllister.
Yeah.
So my brother was ringside. He wanted to see him. Well, I can't remember the bid it was on. But my brother said, Joe, when I seen him go past and him holding the oxygen, and he was, his eyes, he said he was dead, but he survived.
Mm-hmm.
Blessings of God. He said the Brooks run. But the thing is, what they don't understand with weight drain, your body doesn't take fluid from here and fluid from there and fluid from there. It takes from all over. Your brain floats in a shock absorber of fluid. And it's like a shock absorber on a car. Your shocks go on the car. Every pothole you hit, the car shudders. Mm. Your lights go down. Yeah. Everything is affected because of the shuddering, right? The shocks are gone. Your car's in trouble, right? Now, that fluid in your brain acts as a shock absorber. Your brain sits in that fluid. It gets knocked around. It doesn't hit the skull.
Yeah.
It doesn't hit the skull. But when that fluid is drained, the brain hits the skull. Cracks, bleeds, and congeals. And that's where the blood clot starts, from the brain hitting the skull, because the fluid, your shock absorber fluid in your brain is drained. And it happens to a lot of the lighter weights. If you see the brain damage, it's the lighter weights, not the heavyweights, because they don't have to sap their energy by weight loss and fluid loss. Heavyweights, very seldom cruiserweights, very seldom light heavyweights, very seldom super middleweights. From welterweight down, that's where you see the brain injury is coming.
Because it's a necessity. It's every little drop's your necessity.
Well, the fluid is gone. Mm-hmm. So the brain isn't floating in a fluid that stops you hitting the skull. It hits the skull, cracks, congeals, and bleeds and congeals. And that's where the blood clot is. And there's been a few fighters that have been very, very fortunate. Paul Ingle is one. The other kid, lovely kid, Spencer Oliver.
Yeah.
He's doing commentary on the TV now.
Yeah.
I went up, he was doing the commentary with Steve Collins at the Tyson Savarese fight. And I'd fought Savarese as an amateur. So I was VIP'd ringside with Mike. And I fought Steve twice, so we're good friends. And I was with the kid from Birmingham, Martin Concannon, and my other pal Warren Wigan. We were in a ringside, so we were all areas pass. So I saw Spencer, I saw Steve, you know, he's my boyhood friend. And then Martin said, that's Spencer Oliver. And I went over and I shook his hand and I said, I wish you all the very best in your recovery. I said, you're blessed to be alive. He knew himself, but he'd a big mad scar where they'd cut the lump out of his.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a sad thing when it happens, but it happens.
Mm.
Same as the boy, that's what I was saying. It very seldom up, but a lot heavier weights. But the kid that fought Eubanks, good kid from Trowbridge. Mark Kent, my pal, was his manager. Beautiful looking young man as well. Beautiful looking young man. I met him at an event in London. I'd watched him and his brother box unlicensed.
Yeah.
And good fighter, this kid. But when he fought Eubanks Jr., I admire Chris Senior so much because Chris had damaged Michael Watson.
Yeah.
Right. And Chris was ringside and he could see it happening again. And he was screaming at the junior, body, don't hit him to the head, hit him to the body. And they were criticizing, you know, Senior for saying that. And I thought the man is showing compassion. But the trainer that was in the corner with this kid from Trowbridge, a guy called Gary Lockett. Now, Gary had fought for the world title out of Wales. He was in Joe Calzaghe's camp. A great fighter, great guy. But he's as close to the fighter as anybody. And he's looking into his eyes. Do you understand?
Mm.
And it's not his day. So you live to fight another day. Do you understand? The most important is to live. Do you understand?
Mm.
I'd rather stop a fight one punch too early than one punch too late. So you've got the medical ringside that can stop a fight. You've got the doctors and they can stop a fight. You've got the referee that can stop a fight. But the most important man that should stop the fight is the corner man. Yes. Because they are your friend, your guide. You know, the fighter's the last one to know that beat, Kevin. Do you understand? The fighter's pride. But the corner man, your trainer, your friend, you know, he's the man that has to say, listen, let's call it a day today. It's not happening.
Well, I guess he's looking in his fighters' eyes every day, so he knows the slight twinges or the worry or the...
They've sent their fighters off the stool, right? Jared McClelland, when he was sent out against Nigel Benn, the man's... He was blinking like this. The blood was seeping down the back of his eyes from his brain, right? The blood. And he's going like that. And his corner sent him out, right? Fucking brutal. You get emotional about it because I love all the fighters, Kevin, you know. Mm. I love all the fighters. And when you see them killed and paralysed, it just breaks my heart, you know.
That it could have been avoided.
Mm. Every day it could be avoided.
Well, the refs get flack for it, don't they, as well? Stopping the fight too soon. But you can't knock a
ref. I watched Jeff Lacey. I was ringside with Kalzaki. I'm a big fan of Joe's and a good friend. I travelled around the world watching him. He's my pal, you know. Yeah. I went out to America when he fought Hopkins in Vegas. I'm up a ringside in Manchester when he fought Lacey with Rehan, God rest Ricky. And I watched him dismantle Jeff Lacey. Jeff left Hook Lacey, taking him to bits. I'm screaming to stop the fight. Lacey was getting, how his head didn't come off his shoulders. He was hitting him with uppercuts and his head grew. And I'm screaming, stop. Lacey was never the same after that. But the referee let this man take probably one of the most severe beatings I've seen. And Kazakhigan smashed them to bits. Mm. He smashed a lot of men to bits, right? And I'm screaming to the ref from ringside, stop the fight, stop me. He's gone. He's gone. His heart kept him going, right? The corner should have thrown the towel in. British referee, right? 6 months later, we're up in Wales. The referee must have got criticised about the fight with Lacey. Must have, had to have. We're up in Wales. I'm with Danny Kelly of BBC WM. I'm with Tim Witherspoon, ex-heavyweight champion of the world, and my wife. We're ringside for the Manfredo fight, right? Now, Manfredo had won the Contender Series in America. A good fighter, very good fighter. Was on the ropes, he was moving. Kazaki's got him, right? The referee's jumped in and stopped the fight. Now, he was in trouble. But he wasn't getting destroyed.
Yeah.
And I thought, obviously, because of what happened with Lacey, yeah, the referee was on tender hooks, you know, and he's thinking, oh, what do I do here? Because the last fight that Kazaki had.
But then he's going the other way.
Yes. The fight was stopped too soon because he was hitting him to the body and he was covering up and he was rolling. It was hurting him. But you're not going to get worse. You're going to get your ribs broke. I've had mine broke. That's the worst you're going to get. You get winded. You get sickened. I've had that. Do you understand? But you're not going to be killed. Do you understand? If it was head blows, if his head was like Lacey's was, yes.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, why not keep talking boxing? No. Start this interview.
I like it.
Go on.
Yeah,
sorry, great. Kevin.
Brilliant. No, just so.
Right.
As I explained, it's just it's championing people
from
Birmingham. We're shouting about Birmingham. We'll definitely speak about your knife charity as we go on. There's a few questions loosely, but
say I've just come from the gym.
Yeah, man. So it's all on the camera. It's all on the cameras, and we don't normally do an introduction, but for people who God knows how, don't know about you, if you can paint us a picture about young Joe in Birmingham growing up, how was life here?
Well, I came here 31 years ago, but I boxed here. So, okay, whenever you're ready to start.
Yeah, yeah, I'm starting really, yeah.
Are we started already?
Yeah, we're already starting, yeah.
Hey, Kevin, great to see
mate.
You. How are you,
mate? It's been a while.
It's been a good few years. Yeah. It's been a good few years, but it's nice to see you.
And you.
But yeah, I'll give you a little bit of background on me, right? Raised in Dublin as a kid. My dad worked in the UK. I've just come from the gym. I've just finished training.
Yeah.
And I used the gym in Digbeth, Flex Fitness in Digbeth. So we're only across the road, really, from the Blues Grounds. That's why I came straight from the gym.
Class, yeah.
And growing up in Dublin, had a great childhood. I'm the eldest of seven. I got four younger sisters and two younger brothers. Well, my dad, like a lot of the Irish, came to the UK to work, or he went to America to work. So we wouldn't see him sometimes for 11 months of the year. But he would send the money home so my mother could, you know, keep the house and feed us. And we didn't have luxuries. Like, we didn't have chocolate biscuits or anything like that. You know, only the well-to-do with the chocolate biscuits. But we had biscuits. And my mum would make apple pies and rhubarb pies and mince pies. And, you know, we wouldn't be hungry.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot worse off than us. And we would get to visit my dad in the UK maybe once a year, you know, for a holiday. We'd come over on the boat. We'd get the boat from Dublin out to Holyhead, or we'd get the boat from Dublin to Liverpool. And then we'd join him wherever he was working in the UK for a couple of weeks, and he'd spoil us. Or he'd come home, you know, for them few weeks, twice a year, and he'd spoil us, you know. So
what was he working as?
He was into construction work, you know. He was a concrete worker, you know, and he travelled the world as a concrete worker. And he was a hard-working man, you know. I lost my mum and dad in 2022. It was a bad year. My dad passed on the 24th of April, 2022, on his 85th birthday. And my mother went downhill after that. She passed on the 28th of December, 2022. I said I wouldn't cry. I cry a lot, Kevin, you know, and I said I wouldn't cry. I worshipped the ground the two of them stood on, you know what it is. All my life, all I wanted to do was to do them proud. That's all I've ever wanted to do. And I hope I did.
I think so.
I hope I did. But when we used to come to the UK to visit my dad, I got bullied because I had the Irish accent.
Right.
And I got my two front teeth knocked out in Manchester on the day I made my Holy Communion. I was 8 years of age. And the two bully boys, they were like 15 or 16. I was holding on to my Holy Communion medal so they couldn't take my medal. And they knocked my two front teeth out, but they didn't get my medal. All my years boxing, only ever had one tooth knocked out, Kevin. You know, so the boxing ring was probably a safe place for me. But my dad, he encouraged us to do sports, you know, to keep busy. You know, my sisters would do the gymnastics. Me and my brothers would do the boxing or the Gaelic or the judo or the Sea Scouts. He encouraged us to keep busy. Idle hands make work for the devil, you know, and he encouraged us to be doing things. You know, we were very close, all my brothers and sisters. And when my dad was away, I was the man of the house as such, you know, so I had to stop the bullies. When I came to this country, I got bullied because I had the Irish accent. So I picked up the English accent to mix in. And then when I went home to Dublin, I got bullied in Dublin because I had the English accent, you know. So I've been dealing with bullies all my life. But when my dad was away, I was the man of the house. I would mind my brothers and sisters. And when the bullies would beat me, rather than them hit them, I would jump back up and say, no, hit me more. Don't hit them, you know. And I could absorb a beating. I could take a beating. I've took many, many beatings. So when I went into the boxing, really, there was only one man hitting me, you know. Even if it was Mike Tyson and Lennox Lewis, one man. When I got beaten by the bullies, there was always two or more, you know, and you'd be getting kicked and punched, and you might be getting it with sticks or whatever, you know. So the boxing ring was relatively safe. You know, you'd be getting it with
one vision of
You know, and they'd have gloves on, and you'd have a break in between rounds. You'd have the best of medical care at ringside. I never had that luxury when you were getting beaten by the bullies, you know. And I do a lot of anti-bullying, you know. I do a lot of anti-bullying because when I was a kid, you got physically bullied. You know, you get your arm broke, your jaw broke, your nose broke, your leg broke. Whatever the bullies were able to do to you, they would do it, you know. But there'd be a time scale on when the physical injuries would heal, you know. Today, it's mental bullying as well as physical bullying. Right. You know, kids are getting tortured, and adults are getting tortured on the social media, on the mobile phones, on the internet, on the computers, you know. And it's a mental torture. And there's no time scale for healing of a mental torture. And it's horrific what's happening. And then there's people, men, women, children, taking their lives. And the government's saying, oh, it's peer pressure. It's pressure because exams. It's pressure from jobs. They won't admit that it's pressure from bullies, you know, schoolyard bullies, office bullies.
Well, back in the day, I got bullied when I was at school, but you could finish school or finish the hour after school, get back, close your door.
Oh, yeah.
Done, isn't it?
That was a safe haven. You could make the whole close your front door.
If anything, now, because you're not in school, it's rife, it's Snapchat, it's all the social medias, and you just can't escape it, can you? It could be all hours of the morning. It's just relentless.
The internet is a great thing. The World Wide Web is a great thing, but it's also a cruel thing. You know, there's a lot of cruelty on it with people being bullied over it, the social media and the internet and stuff, you know. But my life, it was a good life, but a hard life, Kevin. You know, we like I said, we grew up in Dublin, had hard times, but good times. Mm. You know, like I said earlier on, there's a lot worse off than us. And when my dad was in our company, when he'd be home or when we visit him, we got spoiled, so do nothing. You know, he did bring us to Wimpy was the big thing when we were kids, you know. You know, it's McDonald's and that now, but Wimpy was, you'd go and you get the big Knickerbocker blurry milkshake, you know, and it was great, you know. You'd go to the cinema and you get all the sweets. He really was spoilers, you know. Mum would do the best she could, you know, but it's very hard when she was on her own with seven kids, but she would do the best she could. An incredible, incredible woman. But
do you think that bullying then set you up like for the boxing, that you were kind of like, okay, well, let's learn?
That was the reason why I started boxing. My dad encouraged us. He boxed, and he came from the west of Ireland. My mum's people are traveling people. They came and from Dublin, and they met when she was 15. He was 20. They eloped. They got married. They gave her seven kids. Right. You know, with my mum's people, horse people, Romany people. And good people, you know. I don't know many generations back, three or four or five generations back. One of my mum's granduncle, Giggins Riley, used to lease shire horses to Arthur Guinness. You know, that was a claim to fame by the Riley family, that Giggins Riley was friends with Arthur Guinness. And I don't even drink alcohol. I'm an Irish man that doesn't drink alcohol. People say to me, what sort of an Irishman are you? We're expected
looking
to drink.
Down on you.
The Irish are expected to drink. I said, listen, my dad used to say I'm a failure as an Irishman because I don't drink. I had one Guinness with my dad when I was 16 and I didn't like it. You know, I prefer a glass of milk.
Yeah.
And people laugh at me to this day. I'll be remembered.
I bet you get some jive.
Oh, okay. So listen, I was over in, I was in Marbella at a boxing show, and I bumped into two Spanish promoters. I was introduced to them at the boxing event, and they said, we met you before, Joe. I said, did you? They said, yes. They said, we met you in England. We were over at a boxing event in England. And I said, oh, it's nice to meet you again. They said, there's two things that we remember from you. And I said, well, tell me the two things you remember. They said, we were at the bar, and we were in a crowded bar, and we just saw this very menacing-looking man walking towards us at the bar. And then he said, excuse me, could I get past, please? And I said, that's the first thing, remember, your impeccable manners. And I said, what's the second thing? They said, you ordered a glass of milk at the bar. That was the two Spanish boxing promoters, you know? And it was just, it was funny. It was funny.
Just touching upon that, manners is just the easiest and the most beautiful thing that I think we're losing a little bit, or kids are maybe losing. We've been great, so we're from an Irish family, but that is the thing that's growing into us, that they cost nothing. Can just
cost nothing. Manners cost nothing. Manners make it the person, you know. And when you're remembered for your manners, when people remind you how refreshing it was with manners, it makes it all nice, you know, because sometimes they're appreciated, sometimes they're not, you know. Sometimes people take manners as a weakness, you know. I pride myself on my manners. I'm not weak, but I pride myself on my manners, you know. And it's nice when people compliment you and say, you're very mannerly, you know. I don't want to be known as a tough guy. I want to be known as a personal, mannerly guy, you know, because that's
what... You can be both, though, can't you? You can obviously eat both, but not like, I know what you mean about tough guy kind of.
Listen,
everyone's like, oh,
the world is full of tough guys. The world is full of them. Every street, every city, every country, tough guys in every street, men and women. There's very few mannerly people in every street, in every city, you know, so.
I try and instill it into my kids.
Yeah.
Please and thank you. It gets you
cause
a
nothing.
And
cause
yeah,
nothing.
It's just like, you know, okay, it's refreshing, isn't it? It's just like, okay, yeah. And
man. Listen, kindness.
Kindness, yeah.
Right? That's one of the greatest boxers to ever enter the boxing ring. One of the greatest human beings to ever enter the world, Muhammad Ali. I met him on 4 occasions. I was very, very privileged. I went to his home in Michigan. Al Capone used to own his house. I know he lives in Al Capone's old house. Muhammad Ali, God rest the man. Boxing was blessed to have this man. You know, he could have turned his hand to football, American football, baseball, athletics. He was just a supreme athlete. But he always, always said about manners, you know. He said he wished people would be kind to each other. And he wished there was more manners. He wished there was people would be polite. He tried to push that onto everybody, you know. Mm. And as the heavyweight champion and world greatest of all time, as he said, G-O-A-T, GOAT, greatest of all time.
Yeah.
And he probably was in my eyes.
Yeah.
I think he was,
yeah.
You know. 100%. He's an exceptional human being.
And there's no need for him to be like that, is that? If he wasn't genuinely like that, he didn't have to be like that. It could just be an ask.
He was just a kind man.
You
know, he was just a kind man, and boxing was privileged to have him. The world was privileged to have him, you know. He was just an exceptional human being, you know. And like I said, when I met him on 4 occasions, you're in the presence of greatness, you know. It's just that I love the sport of boxing, and I idolized that man. I used to do an Ali shuffle as a tribute to him. You know, I couldn't lace his boots. I couldn't lace his gloves, but I used to love him.
An inspiration to a generation, wasn't it?
Yes. Even the Rocky story. People think that the Rocky story is just a figment of Sylvester Stallone's imagination. The Rocky story comes from the Muhammad Ali story, because I tell you how it came about. There's a man called Chuck Wepner, the Bayonne Bleeder. And Muhammad Ali, when he won the title, he wanted to do a tour of America. For people that don't know this is fact. He wanted to do a tour of America, and he was going to give the 50 state champions a shot at the heavyweight champion of the world. Once a month, he was going to fight the state champion. Now, New Jersey was the capital of boxing at the time, Atlantic City. I fought Atlantic City twice. I fought in the Sands Hotel and Casino, the Tropicana Hotel and Casino. I never fought in Vegas, but I fought in Atlantic City twice. But New Jersey was the capital of boxing at the time. Vegas took over after that.
Mm.
But the New Jersey champion, Bayonne, New Jersey, was Chuck Wepner. So he was the first opponent of Muhammad Ali. Anyway, Chuck Wepner got the chance of a lifetime to fight the heavyweight champion of the world as a state champion. Not even a contender for the American title, don't mind the world title. So the man fought like a Trojan. He fought like a bat out of hell. He fought like a Spartan. And he went to 15 rounds with Muhammad Ali in a war. Muhammad Ali said to his management team, I can't do this every month. He said, I can't do this. He said, if this is what's going to come at me every month, I can't do this.
Yeah.
And the tour was stopped after the first fight. Now, Chuck Wepner was friends with Sylvester Stallone. And Chuck Wepner and Sylvester Stallone done a script. Chuck Wepner, Rocky, Apollo Creed, Muhammad Ali, the champion giving the state champion a shot at the title. So the story of the Rocky script came from the Chuck Wepner, Muhammad Ali fight. It was actually based on that
story.
But they couldn't say Muhammad Ali and Chuck Wepner, so they said Rocky and Apollo Creed.
Yeah.
And Chuck Wepner was an enforcer for business people. He was a debt collector. So Rocky was an enforcer for business people, a debt collector, down on his luck. There were so many similarities of Chuck Wepner. And the rest of them, 2, 3, 4, 5, all come from the success of the first one.
You take it where you want that kind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And fair play to Sylvester Stallone and fair play to Chuck Wepner, because they've inspired so many people to box because of the success of Rocky.
Yeah.
You know, I've never met Chuck Wepner. I met Sylvester Stallone at dinner with Sylvester Stallone. Great actor, great guy, you know. And the Rocky films, I trained to the music. Eye of the Tiger.
Oh, yeah.
It won the Academy Award in 1980 for the music.
The soundtrack, yeah.
Oh, incredible.
Brilliant.
You know, and then Mickey, his trainer, He was, a lot of people, remember the old Batman? He was the Penguin in Batman. I'm sure he was the Penguin. Burgess Meredith, right, a great actor, but he played Mickey. He played Rocky's trainer, you know. Now, there's gyms in America. I was in a lot of gyms in America. There's loads of characters like Mickey, you know, ex-fighters that have been there, done it, seen it all, you know. Yeah. And he portrayed Sylvester's Rocky's trainer so good.
But, yeah, his character in that is just like you say, it's you've probably seen a lot of them, and it's just grabbed, but it's just... It all comes together, doesn't it? That film to be like—it's
an incredible film.
Yeah.
And then they've made the other films a success as well. You know, he's fighting the rematch with Apollo Creed, and then he's fighting Clubber Lang, and then he's fighting Ivan Drago, then he's fighting Tommy Gunn. I'm doing a documentary for Tommy Morrison, God rest him.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing a documentary about Tommy Morrison, and his wife has contacted, his widow, excuse me, yeah. Trisha Morrison. She's contacted me from America, Netflix, are doing a documentary. Yeah. I had the privilege of doing a tour with Tommy and Tony TNT Tucker. Give you a funny story. I'm going to tell it on the documentary anyway. George Chivallo and Ken Norton were to do the tour. They do a lot of after-dinner speaking events in the UK. And Wally Dixon, the promoter from Manchester, had brought over many fighters to do talks around the UK. And he'd arranged for Ken Norton and George Chivallo to come over and do a tour of the UK. Ken got sick and couldn't travel. So alongside George Chivallo, he put in Tommy Morrison and he put in Tony TNT Tucker. So I've got to do the tour. I'm really the support act to these great champions. I'm like the rodeo clown. I warm up the audience, right? But it's a privilege and an honor to sit next to these legends of the ring. They achieved what I dreamed of achieving. You know, every fighter that climbs into the ring, Kevin, dreams about becoming a champion of the world. I wasn't good enough. I was nowhere near good enough. But I shared the ring with other great champions. You know, and I'm proud to say that they're my friends as well, because that's the great thing about boxing. It doesn't just give you self-respect, it gives you respect for your opponent, you know, and that's such an important thing in life, to have self-respect and respect for others, and I believe boxing instills that. Anyway, we're on this tour. Now, Tony TNT Tucker, is nearly 6'7". Is a big, big, powerful man, right? So when we're in the major cities, you're in hotels with big beds. So we're in a little village in Wales and we're in the guest house, okay? And the beds were standard size beds,
mm-hmm.
right? So Tony, 6'7", he's come down, we're downstairs, me and Tommy Morris, Tommy's wife, his widow now, and Wally Dixon. So Tony's gone down, he goes, Wally, come up to the room, Wally. So Wally said, what's wrong, Tony? He said, Wally, the bed's too small, man, the bed's too small. So he goes, okay, let me see. And Wally's a little Manchester businessman. So I said to Tommy, come on, let's go and see this, right? I didn't encourage Trisha to come to the man's room. So me and Tony and Wally have walked into the room. So Tony's lay on the double bed and his legs are hanging out over the edge of the bed. I'm talking nearly a foot over the edge of the bed, hanging off. Wally, look, man. He says, my feet are hanging out of the bed. What am I going to do, Wally? I've got to get another bed, Wally. So I could see Wally's mind. There's no way we could get another bed. We're in a little village in Wales, right? In a guest house. So Wally goes, I know what to do, Tony. Lie diagonally, right? And Tony goes, lie diagonally, what? Yes, lie diagonally. So Tony lays on the bed diagonally. There you go, Tony. Your feet aren't hanging off the edge of the bed. Me and Tommy Morrison, we were in convulsions laughing. But Tony accepted it. He said, okay, Wally, I'll sleep diagonally on the bed. So he's from one corner to the other corner. He's sleeping diagonally, so he's sleeping. But it was so funny, the two-time heavyweight champion of the world, an incredible champion. Oh. And Wally Dixon telling him, lie diagonally, Tony, your feet won't hang over the bed. It was just funny. But Tommy Morrison, what a great guy and what a great champion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The grandnephew of John Wayne, the Duke. And that was his nickname when he boxed, Tommy the Duke Morrison. Sadly, he was took from us too young. But he's left his legacy. He was an incredible champion. And I had the privilege, like I say, of sharing the top table with him. And he's a real nice guy. But most fighters are nice guys. I've been very fortunate over the years. I've shared the top table. I've shared the gym with so many great champions.
Who were the main faces around Birmingham at the time?
Oh, there's been some great fighters out of the Midlands.
Yeah.
Matt Macklin is legendary. Pat Cowdell is legendary. Wayne Elcock is legendary. Frankie Gavin, legendary. We've had some great fighters in the Midlands, you know.
I think it's growing up in this city as well at a certain time, and those guys from them ages have to be similar to your story.
There's been some great Midlands champions that have boxed for British titles, won British titles, and have performed well, you know. There's been some great amateurs. We boxed here as amateur when I was a kid. We came over from Dublin. Some legendary boxing gyms, you know. The boys at the moment, you got the Afoy brothers. They're champions. Yeah. They boxed at a Birmingham City Boxing Club. You know, Frank Sullivan, we boxed against his club as a child, the McCrackens. You know, Robert McCracken, Max McCracken, Spencer McCracken, you know.
Sam Higginson as well. We had John Pegg on recently.
John Pegg, a great, great manager, promoter. Mm. You know, young McIntosh, Eddie McIntosh, he fought him in Prize Fighter. But so great, great, great promoters, great fighters. You know, there's a good tradition of boxing in the Midlands. Yeah. You know, Wayne Elcock's got his sports shop now. He's supplying the gyms.
Yeah.
He's got a wonderful sports shop. And you've had some great rivalry with the years ago, there was the Ramsey brothers. They were great fighters, you know. And then there was Christian Brady. He was number one contender for the British title, great welterweight. Malcolm Melvin, another great fighter, fought for the British title.
So let's get on to how you ended up sparring with.
And what happened was, I went over to America. Kevin, I went over to America on the Irish boxing team, I was 17, and I boxed in Atlantic City. I fought in the Tropicana Hotel and Casino. I fought in 1988 in the Sands Hotel and Casino. I fought Bruce Seldon. He went on to win the World Heavyweight title. I beat him. He went on to win the World Heavyweight title, best win of my career. But at that stage, I'd already fought Lennox. I'd already been sparring twice, and so I'd improved. But when I fought the American champion when I was 17, a big American Marine called William Dawson. He was 28, I was 17. He was a mature man, strong, powerful man. I was a teenage boy, a little fat boy as well. And but I was game, you know. And I got battered, you know. But I stayed on my feet, Kevin, for the three rounds. And Floyd Patterson was in attendance. His wife was from Offaly in Ireland, so he took a great interest in the Irish team. And he encouraged Paul Fitzgerald, the featherweight, who won, being a top American. He encouraged him to stay in America. Paul still lives in America. He lives in a place called Upper Darby in Pennsylvania. Is in Philadelphia. Is it Pennsylvania? Philadelphia. Upper Darby. Where they made the Rocky film, Philadelphia. So I saw the Rocky statue and I went to visit him. Live Aid was filmed there.
Yep.
And I saw the Rocky statue. But Paul lives there now. But he stayed on. Floyd Patterson gave him the opportunity to stay because he was an incredible featherweight from Arklow in Ireland. But he came over to me and he said, you got a lot of courage and you got a good chin. You don't have a lot of skill, but we can work on your skill. Would you like to stay in America? I wouldn't have had the money to come back to America, Kevin. So I said, yeah, I'll stay. So I remember phoning my mum. My dad was in England somewhere working. I remember phoning my mum. And I said, Mom, I said, Floyd Patterson has given me the chance to stay in America. I'm going to stay. She said, you'll never come home, son. I said, we're home next year, Mom. I'm going to stay for a year, give it a go, see how it goes. So I went to Gleason's gym with Floyd. And he introduced me to Al Gavin and Bob Jackson, who'd done the original deal with Cuss on the gym. And they had me spar in the gym with Art Tucker, who was a good heavyweight, and another heavyweight. I can't remember his name. And I gave a good account of myself. But these were mature men. I was a teenage fat boy. But it was a game teenage fat boy, you know. It was tough. Like all fighters, we're all tough, male and female. Anyway, Al and Bob said to me, there's a young heavyweight in the Catskills called Mike Tyson, 17 years of age, looking for sparring partners. I was just so happy to hear 17, because I'd been fighting men, mature big men. I left school when I was 14 years of age. I was on the doors of nightclubs, Kevin, when I was 15. I don't read or write so good. I wanted to make my livelihood through boxing. I wasn't good in school. I left school with 2 swimming certificates. So... that's what left school with. But I had a dream of becoming a rich boxer.
Yeah.
And I didn't become a rich boxer, but I gave it a go. Anyway, so when Al and Bob gave me the chance to go and spar with a young heavyweight called Mike Tyson, I'd never heard of Mike. I didn't know who he was. He was knocking men out left, right, and center. I didn't know this. So I got to the Catskills. I was introduced to Cuss and Camille and Marnie and Jay and Tom and the Hilton brothers. And it was a lovely, warm reception. You know, it was so wonderful, the greeting that I was given on arrival. Then they introduced me to Mike Tyson. And I remember him walking towards me, because fighters, we weigh up who we're going to be fighting, who we're going to be sparring. So Cuss called over Mike. Yes, this is Mike. So I'm looking and I'm walking towards me, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm bigger than him. As it turned out, I'm several months older than him. And he spoke with a little bit of a lisp as I was introduced to him. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to batter you. Really, I thought I've got the measure of this kid.
Yeah.
Because I'll be fighting men, I'm bigger, I'm older, a lot more experience than him at the time. And he embraced me. He gave me a big welcome, you know, because he loved the history of the Irish boxers. He loved Barry McGuigan in particular at the time, who was being managed by Mr. Eastwood. And when I went professional, when my boxing, I went professional with Mr. Eastwood. I'm a big fan of Barry McGuigan's. And Mike loved the relationship that Barry had with Mr. Eastwood, because it was a similar relationship, father and son, like Mike had with Cuss. So he wanted to hear all about the Irish boxing that I knew.
Yeah.
You know, and at the time I knew a fair bit about Barry because he was my hero. You know, he was the Irish world champion. Anyway, we became instant friends. We walked, we talked. Mike at the whole top of the house, beautiful big house on the Hudson River. They say the myth that Rip Van Winkle slept up there for 40-odd years, it was so tranquil and peaceful, you know, and it was beautiful. There was 2 sides of the Catskill Mountains that were populated by the Germans and populated by the Irish. There was a big, big Irish. Well, in America, there's a big history of the Irish anyway, you know. They say that Columbus discovered America. And I beg to differ, because when Columbus landed his ship to Santa Maria, on the coast of America, and he rode up, he had the, what was it, the Santa Maria de Nin and the Pinta ships anyway, and he rode up onto the coast of America, and he stepped off his rowing boat, and he's looking up the hill at the American Indian, because they are the natives of Americans, the American Indian,
yeah,
that was their country. So the American Indian is walking down the hill towards Columbus, and Columbus is walking up the hill towards the American Indian. And Columbus put his hand out to shake hands with the American Indian. And the American Indian looked him in his eyes and went, top of the morning to you. So the Irish were there first. before Columbus. Paddy Lanada. His rowing boat. He landed his rowing boat on the coast of America. Don't care what anybody says. We were there first. So me and Mike became great friends instantly through the history of Irish boxing. Went to the top of the house and Mike had access to Jim Jacobs and Bill Caden's library of boxing footage. They're the biggest library in the world. They're part of his management team. So he had old cine reels of fights. And to me, there's only so much boxing you can watch. To Mike Tyson, there wasn't enough. He would sit on his exercise bike and he would watch the fights and he'd say to me, Joe, man, if that left hook that had landed, that would have changed the history of that weight division. You know, he's like a walking encyclopedia on the history of boxing. Unreal. Unreal. He loves the sport, loves the fighters. Anyway, we went up to the top of the house and I lived in the house with Mike. I had one of the rooms in the house because we were teenage boys. What I didn't realise was there was another part of the Catskills where other sparring partners were living in the annex, right? So when I sat at the first dinner meal in the house, I've got to tell you, it's a funny story, this, Kevin, right? I'm at the dinner table, right? And there's Mike, Camille, Manny, Tom, Jade, Hilton Brothers. And every household has a different rule at the dinner table. My dad used to encourage, no elbows on the table. Don't talk while you're eating, right? So different households have different rules, right? So Camille has brought out the starter, the soup, right? So I put my spoon in and started eating my soup. And I looked at Camille and I went, Camille, this is gorgeous soup. Anyway, Cus put his spoon down and sat back. And he looked at me. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm not supposed to be speaking at the dinner table while we're eating. And he looked at me, he says, Joe, he said, I've often heard of a woman being called gorgeous, but never a soup. And he started laughing. And the table started laughing. And I thought to myself, my kind of people.
Yeah.
Because there's thousands of languages in the world, Kevin. We all speak different languages. And sometimes we don't know what each other is saying, but we all laugh in the same language. Laughter breaks down barriers. Yeah. And of course, had a hearty laugh. And I just knew then, at that moment in time, even though I'd been made welcome on arrival and I'd been made welcome with Mike with his embrace, that moment there, I just knew. And I lived in the Catskills for 2 years. Two probably wonderful years, you know, of my life. But when I got to spar with Mike, the next day, we'd gone running in the morning, and Mike was an incredible runner. And for a heavyweight, that's a great thing to do, run. Heavyweights don't particularly like running, you know.
Yeah.
So for heavyweight to be a good runner, that's great. So Mike was, he was like a gazelle. He could shift on the road. We've come back to the house after our run. Had a bite to eat, lay down, rested till the time to go to the gym in the minibus. So now I'm going to the gym. I'm coming out to the minibus to go to the gym to spar. I'm thinking, yeah, Mike, we've done our run. We're going to spar now this afternoon, this evening. Next of all, these big, powerful men appeared. I hadn't seen them. They were in different pilots.
Yes.
And they were walking. Big beasts of men. But they were walking like men going to the gallows. They were very somber, their heads hanging down. I'm looking, I'm thinking to myself, what's the problem with all them? But they knew what was coming. Stupid Paddy here didn't know what was coming. I had the only clue, Kevin. Right?
I had the clue. The unknown.
They were, yeah. But I was so relaxed. I really believed. I've got the measure of this kid. I'm bigger. I'm older, I'm more experienced. But they knew, these other sparring partners knew. So when we're on the bus, going to the gym, the Main Street Catskills above the police station, I'm nice and relaxed, I'm comfortable. You know, I'm feeling confident. Not an arrogance, just a confidence. Got to the gym, got into our training gear, bandaged up, shadow box, warmed up. Then Cus said, right, glove up, we're sparring. So I'm looking around to see where Mike is. Next of all, I see him in the ring and he's stripped to the waist and his upper body. There's no way 70
it's the first time you've seen it.
Stripped to the waist. Yeah. You know, I couldn't believe the biceps, the chest, the neck. His body was incredible, powerful, and he's pacing the ring like the lion in the cage. When you're at the zoo and the lion walks up and down and he's looking out at you, it's like Mike was the same as that lion. He's in the ring, pacing the ring, looking out at his next victim, his next prey, right? I'm looking, I'm thinking to myself, ooh. Cuz pointed to one of the big, powerful men to get in and spar. Bang. First shot. Bang. Out for the count. And I'm looking. I tell people, I ruined a good pair of underpants at that moment. I shit myself. I thought, there's no way this 17-year-old boy should have this power. He's just knocked Spark out, a powerful, big beast of a man. Couple more got in. Battered, knocked out. I was number four. I got in. But I lasted 3 minutes. I lasted longer than the previous three sparring partners. But the madness in me, because I do believe fighters have a bit of madness in them. You know, you play football, you play golf, you play tennis, you play basketball, you don't play fighting. Muay Thai, kickboxing, jiu-jitsu, karate, any full contact form of fighting, boxing, you don't play. It's not a game. It's a combat sport. Mm. It's a combat sport. And you get hurt. Mm. You know, sadly, there's been fatalities. We don't get into the ring. We don't get into the cage. We don't get onto the mat to kill. We get onto the mat, the cage, the ring to win, you know, and we fight. And Mike Tyson was one of the most incredible punches that I've ever been hit with. And I've been hit by some hard punches in my time, you know. But I'm very proud to say that I stayed on my feet for the 2 years of sparring, you know, and it's a great claim to fame when I fought Lennox Lewis. I really believe psychologically I've took Mike Tyson's punishment. I could take Lennox Lewis's punishment. And I stayed on my feet with Lennox Lewis because of fighter's pride. You want to hear that final bell. You know, there's that poem, stand up and fight, fight like hell. Stand up and fight until you hear that final bell. And that's all a fighter wants to be in there, to hear that final bell. I hadn't got a chance against Lennox Lewis. He had to have the worst day of his career and I'd have the best day of my career to have any sort of chance. But I wanted to hear that final bell. My own victory, my own moral victory, to be there at the end of the fight, you know. And I did, because psychologically, I took Tyson's punishment, Mike Tyson's punishment. I could take Lennox's, Lewis's punishment. And this particular day we sparred, me and Mike, and those four white sparring partners. He knocked three of them. I was number four. And he battered me from pillar to post, but he never put me down. And at the end of the spar, he said, Joe Egan is the toughest white man on the planet. Far, far, far from it, Kevin. I was the toughest white man in the gym that day. But what a compliment.
Brilliant.
Listen, I got battered by Mike and I got battered by Lennox Lewis. But if you're going to get battered, you must have got battered by the best. I got battered by the best, you know. And people say, Joe, you milk it a little bit. Yeah, do milk it. I've earned the right to milk it.
Yeah, exactly.
I've earned the right to milk it. I'll be on a life support machine and I'll be lying there and I'll be, I sparred Mike Tyson. You know, I've earned the right.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, they say you've walked the walk, you're entitled to talk the talk, you know, and it's not egotistical. I'm not egotistical in any way, shape or form. It's just, it's something I'm very proud of. You know, and I'm a proud man, you know, about the royalty out of respect, about the no man out of fear, you know, and that walk to the boxing ring has helped me overcome so much fear in my life. You know, it's two spellings of the word fear. The coward spells fear, forget everything and run. The fighter spells fear, face everything and rise. And that's what I've been all my life. You know, I've been a fighter and win, lose, or draw, I've given my best. But Bruce Seldon, when I fought Seldon, he was incredible. He was special. He went on to win the World Heavyweight title. And I got battered in round one. I mean, smashed to bits, Kevin. Psychologically, I believed I could take it. I've took it off Mike. Mike made me cry so many times, hospitalized me a few times. I've took it off Lennox Lewis. So I really believed in my heart. I could take it off Seldon. But my corner men, Mickey Hawkins and Jerry Anna, they didn't think that I could. They're compassionate corner men. And they said, Joe, we're going to retire you on your stool after round one. I said, I'm not quitting on my stool. Winners never quit and quitters never win. I can take this. The referee stops it, you got no argument, right? So I've left my stool for round two. I've walked out. Selden couldn't believe that I was walking up my stool to come to the centre of the ring to fight because he'd hurt me, battered me in round one. I walked to the centre of the ring. As he's looking at me, the bell went to hit him. I couldn't get near him in round one. He was too fast, too graceful, too brilliant. But for that split second, he stood still. And in my body shot, Kevin, it was the best punch that I could throw. I've got a good body shot. I sunk it into him, smashed it into his ribs, right? And he winced. Oh! And I knew I hurt him. And I slowed him down. And I went on to win the best win of my career. And it was an incredible victory. And he went on, like I said, to win the world heavyweight title. But after the fight, after I got to hospital, I'm all busted up. Even though I won, I'm busted up from round one anyway. I'm busted up. And I've got to hospital in the ambulance. There was 10 great champions of the world in attendance. Rocky Graziano, Jersey Joe Walker, Jake LaMotta, Jersey Joe Walker. I said, Rocky Graziano, Jake LaMotta, Jersey Joe Walker, Sandy Sadler, Billy Conn, Vito Antifermo, Floyd Patterson, Chico Vigia, Alexis Arguello. And anyway, 10 great champions in attendance. We were boxing in their honour. I got two programmes signed, one for me and one for my dad. Got two programmes signed by these 10 legends of the ring. And we were boxing in their honour. But what I didn't realise outside of the ring, I had enough problems inside of the ring. What I didn't realise outside of the ring, Jake LaMotta, the Raging Bull, he was fighting the fight with me. He was throwing punches and he tripped and he cut his eye and hurt his arm. Right? So I'm in the back of the ambulance. I'm in a lot of pain. The adrenaline's wearing off. And I'm wondering what the delay is. I knew I hadn't hurt Selden like he'd hurt me. So he wasn't being hospitalised. Jake LaMotta is brought to the back of the ambulance, the Raging Bull. And he looked at me and he goes, the heavyweight, great fight kid. Best anaesthetic I've ever had. The pain was lifted. The Raging Bull.
Come again.
The Raging Bull complimented me on a win. But anyway, we became friends. And I kept in touch with the man. And I visited him in New York at home in Florida as well. Him and his wife, Denise. Me and my wife, Ruth, we visited him. We had dinner with him in New York. My wife's a Birmingham girl, Ruth Delaney. And I got a lot of affection for Birmingham. I got a lot of friends here and family through Ruth. Mm-hmm. But we had dinner with him in New York in Gallagher Steakhouse and had the press conference for him and his fight with, one of his fights with, God, I've gone blank again. Anyway, so I'm in the back of the ambulance with Jake and I'm lifted with the pain because of the compliment. But he'd done dinners over here and I shared the top table with him. And we'd done a dinner in Carlisle. Steve Collins' brother, Roddy, had managed the Carlisle soccer team.
Right.
And Steve was doing the dinner with me and Jake LaMotta, you know.
Brilliant.
And then they agreed to do a book signing because I had a book written about me. Mike Tyson launched the book in Canary Wharf, 2005. Pardon me, one of the proudest days of my life. Cass Pennant published the book. Randall Graham wrote the book. Mike launched the book, brought Canary Wharf to a standstill. Steve Collins has come to the book signing. Barry McGuigan's come to the book signing. Loads of world champions, Paul Silky Jones, Alan Minter, Charlie Magri, these legends of the ring have come to my book signing, thousands of people. I know everybody was there for Mike Tyson, but he was there for me. I did the book signing in Carlisle after the dinner with Steve Collins and Jake LaMotta, and they both attended the book signing. And we were interviewed by the press, the BBC, the ITV. Everybody was there to interview Jake LaMotta at the book signing. A very proud day. And the interviewer said to Jake, do you know Joe a long time? He said, me and Joe go way back. He said, Joe was like me. Joe would fight anybody. I thought, what a compliment from the Raging Bull. But he looked at me, he goes, but he wasn't so fat then. You know, I put a bit of weight on when my career finished, you know. So you're like,
yeah, yeah, but
The guy that was filming it for me, a guy called Liam Galvin, it's on my DVD. Liam said, should I cut it out, to edit it out? I said, no, not ashamed to put the weight on.
Yeah.
You know, like my food.
Yeah.
People ask me what my favorite meal is. I say seconds. That's my favorite meal. You know, I love food, you know, and some people eat to live. I live to eat.
Yeah.
I really.
And so having to say that, it just shows.
I already do, you know, and
your relationship. This,
yeah. Wow. But it was beautiful. And like I say, we had dinner with him in New York in Gallagher Steakhouse. And I'd done a few book signings with him. And I visited him in his apartment in Manhattan. And I took my brother-in-law. My sister Constance is married to an ex-New York cop. She married him when he was becoming a policeman in New York, NYPD. And he retired after 20 years. They live in North Carolina now because the taxes are cheaper from the pension than the New York taxes. So they live in a place called Apex. They live on a road called Apex Boulevard Road. What a beautiful name for a road, you know. And
it's amazing.
They've been together a lot of years. They've got two children, Tom and Lucia. And he's a good man. You know, he's a good man. She's my younger sister. She's the eldest of the four girls. But me and Joe.
It has to be a good man now for big brothers.
Yeah, well, very fortunate. You know, I've been very fortunate with my brothers and sisters. They've all got good partners. You know, I haven't had my four sisters' partners, husbands. They've been very blessed. You know, they've all got children. I haven't got any kids. Me and my wife decided we didn't want children. Children wasn't for me. And my wife loved me enough not to have children. You know, and I'm a good uncle. I have loads of nephews and nieces, but the great thing about having nephews and nieces, you can give them back. You know. Anyway, we got two cats. Me and Joe, we got to visit Jake in his apartment in Manhattan because Joe's grandmother had lived on the same street as Jake LaMotta. And Joe's name is Joe Marcatelli. He's an Italian, of Italian descent. So Jake LaMotta's Italian descent. So he's obviously one of the Marcatelli's heroes, same as Rocky Graziano, one of the Marcatelli's heroes.
Yeah.
And we went to visit Jake in his apartment, and he made me so proud in front of my brother-in-law. But he said, Joe, he said, it's great to have you here in my home, and Denise's wife made us so welcome. He said, I've got to clarify one thing, Joe. He said, in front of your brother-in-law, you ain't the toughest white man on the planet. I'm the toughest white man on the planet. Who's going to argue with Jake LaMotta that he's not the toughest white man? He's the raging bull.
All right, yeah. You know? Anyone else, you'd be like... Yeah.
But it was such fun. The fact that he even said that, you know. And I said to my brother-in-law, how cool was that?
That is so cool.
He said it was brilliant, you know, to be in Jake LaMotta's home. So my brother-in-law, Joe Marcatelli, had that privilege the same as I had.
So,
to be in his home that day. But I've been very blessed over the years. You know, I've lived a hard life, but a good life, Kevin,
yeah.
You know. And
I was going to move on to fast forward now.
Go on.
So how you've offered John Fury out?
Oh, listen, that's...
I like it. I like your videos.
I tell you what...
It's obviously Tyson's retired now, so it could be the biggest Fury boxing match around, couldn't it?
Well, the thing is, right, what happened with me and him, right? Like I said earlier, my mother's people are traveling people. So I come from that community, right? I've got a lot of family in the traveling community. And I told me and him were friends. You know, I've done dinner shows with him. We've done a show down in Great Yarmouth. Tyson lives in Morecambe. We've done a show in Great Yarmouth for another traveling man, Leon. He put the show on. And it was during the break in COVID, me, Paddy Doherty, and John. And the room was full of 1,000 travellers. You know, great atmosphere, great cracks. I've done shows with John, you know. I've done shows with Tyson. I'm a massive fan of Tyson, you know. I'm a big fan of his other son, Tommy. You know, I know the Fury family. I know his brother, Peter. He's my friend. You know, Peter's trained Yui, his son, and he's trained some great champions. And I've got the greatest of respect for the Fury family. And like I said, I thought John was my friend. So there was a movie premiere in Cannes of a film that I did called Prize Fighter. Russell Crowe of the Gladiator fame, he's in the film. Ray Winston, iconic British actor.
Legend.
Brilliant. I've done three films with Ray. And he's an ex-boxer, a Repton. He's my friend. You know, me and my wife have had dinner with him. you know, with his wife. And a great guy, really, really down to earth, humble, dignified, and incredible actor. So he's at the premiere. And I couldn't attend the premiere, I was working. But Matt Pearce, who's the actor in the film and the producer of the film, his father, Dave Pearce, was the ex-British heavyweight champion, who's dead now, God rest him. Well, Matt phoned me and said, yo, Tyson Fury's in town in Cannes for the premiere of Maverick. Prizefighter premiered before Maverick, 6 to 8, Maverick was 8 to 10. So he said, is there any possibility you could get Tyson to come to the premiere? So I said, yeah. So I contacted Tyson. I told him about Matt Pearce. He obviously knew who Dave was, his former British heavyweight champion. And he said, yeah, I'll attend the premiere. So Tyson attended the premiere. John was at the premiere. Russell Crowe said to John, in front of Ray Winston, in front of Matt Pearce, there's another boxer in the film, Joe Egan. Do you know Joe? And instead of John saying, yeah, Joe's my friend, he goes, Joe's a fraud. Joe's a fake hard man. I've never claimed to be a hard man. Never in my life. People that have battered me have said Joe's a tough guy. Joe's a hard man. I've never claimed it. Ray Winston went, ooh, Russell Crowe. And when I got told that, I was so upset. Very, very upset, because I thought, he's supposed to be my friend, but he's a glory hunter. He doesn't even give Tyson, the heavyweight champion of the world, his glory. He doesn't give Tommy, a professional fighter, his glory. He doesn't give his brother Peter, an incredible trainer, glory. He doesn't give Huey glory, his nephew. He wants the glory himself. So what chance have I got of getting any glory? You know? So when I got told this, I was very upset, because I thought the man was my friend. So I thought, got to see him. Then he's on the stage shouting, he's the hardest 58-year-old man on the planet. No, he's not. And neither am I. But I got a grudge, so we fight. So I stood up to the mark and I said, John, you've insulted me, we fight. Damn, are they unworthy of a fight with me. Like he's something special. Neither of us were any good. Truth be told, Kevin, he was just tough, the same as I'm tough. You know, he wasn't going to be a world champion, neither was I. And two donkeys make a good race, right? And that's the way it is. Yeah. I'm no class boxer or class fighter. I was just tough. He was the same. I've been hit by 4 heavyweight champions of the world and not knocked out. He was hit by 1 and knocked out. So I believe my chin's better than his. And I've got a grievance. I've got a grudge. Then he's saying, damn, they aren't worthy of a fight with him. Like he's something special. I've earned the right to be called by my own name in fight circles. I might be a damn or a day to a football player, or a golfer, a tennis player, a basketball player. But in fight circles, we've earned the right to be called by our own name. So I said, John, you call me by my own name. I've earned the right to be called by my own name. So then, because of me standing up to him, because I do believe he's a bully, right? He's been shown to be a bully. When he headbutted that young man out in Saudi, the young Ukrainian that was cheering for Usyk, he headbutted him. He walked past all the big men to headbutt the little guy. That shows the bully in him, right? So I stood up to the mark. I said, John, you've insulted me. We fight. I'm not going to say see in court. We fight. Then Misfits jumped on board. KSI, MAMS. They've jumped on board because they've got a history with Joe Fury through KSI Boxing Tommy.
Yeah.
You know? So they've jumped on board. And they've offered a lot of money for the fight. A lot of money. More money than I've ever earned. I know he would have got the bulk of it because he's the heavyweight champion of the world, Daddy. But even if I got a fraction of it,
yeah,
still a lot of money. Yeah. 35 years ago, I was fighting for £5,000 a fight. Now this talk of millions.
Stupid money, isn't it?
Unreal. Mm. These YouTubers are making fortunes, and fair play to them. Yeah. They're bringing the sport to the masses.
Mm.
You know, and I compliment them because they walk the walk. They get into that ring and they fight. Yet they're getting paid a substantial amount of money because they're getting a substantial audience. That World Wide Web has opened up, the boxing world. Now, if the likes of KSI or the likes of Jake Paul have hundreds of millions of fans, which they do, and hundreds of millions of fans watch them box, they might not necessarily watch boxing. And 1% of 200 million fans suddenly decide, I like the sport of boxing. I'm going to watch other boxing. I'm going to watch amateur boxing. I'm going to watch professional boxing. I'm going to watch other white-collar boxing. That's 1 million or 2 million fans that the sport has gained. So how can it be bad for the sport? I think it's great for the sport. I think they've opened up a new fan base. And when after, was it Freddie Flintoff, the cricket player, he boxed.
Yeah.
It was front page news. The man boxed an American that had 2 wins. He's getting in for his first fight against an unbeaten fighter. And I complimented Freddie Flintoff. I said, listen, I admire you. I respect you. You've been a world-class cricket player. You're giving the go to boxing now. And you got front page news. And he opened up the boxing world to the cricket fans that might not necessarily have watched boxing. And I just think it's great.
There's a fall off from them thinking, oh, all right, oh, I'll have a look or I'll get involved. Those kids that watch cricket think, oh.
Yeah, I want the sport to blossom. Mm. I want amateur boxing to blossom. I want professional boxing to blossom. I want white-collar boxing to blossom.
Mm.
You know, I just love the sport of boxing. And I'm an ex-boxer that if the fight came up with John Fury, I'd fight, you know.
Yeah.
I want to fight the man. I want to get well paid for it because the money that's been dangled around, Conor McGregor's people have offered a lot of money for a bare-knuckle fight. I've had many bare-knuckle fights. You know, no problem. I'll stand on the cobbles with John Fury and we'll fight and the best man will win, you know. And I tell people, listen, I haven't cycled a bike for a lot of years, but I know I could go out onto the streets and cycle a bike. I'm not going to win Tour de France, you know, but I know to cycle a bike. I haven't been in a boxing ring for a lot of years, Kevin, but I know my way around the boxing ring. Me and John Fury are too old to be dancing around the boxing ring. We'll stand in front of each other and we'll punch each other till one of us breaks. And I believe he'll break before me. I'd like to think that he'd break before me. I hope I'm right. I might be wrong. I might break before him. But give me the chance.
A lot of people that will watch that, though, wouldn't
I? I believe so. I've done a video, I said there.
I've seen some of your videos.
Oh, listen, I've had some fun doing the videos, right? I've had some fun.
I can see you having
fun. Because I don't curse, right? I don't swear. I don't want to belittle the man. I don't want to call him names, right? But I want the fight. I want the opportunity to put right what he said about me, right? And give me that opportunity. But I've done some funny videos. I done one, I said, John, you're the most hated man on this planet. And if there's life out there on other planets, which I believe there is, I said, even the extraterrestrials hate you as well. I had millions and millions and millions of views. The amount of comments, compliments, funny.
Because you know? There's some reason they're in the style of when the traveling yeah. people and they're kind of running in. It's like there's an audience for it now because people take that to an extent, and then you're doing that now. It's just, brilliant. I can see you having fun with it. You like
personally, right? Personally, I would love the fight to happen, right?
Yeah.
Because the money, right? And it's
got to happen.
I'd love it to happen, you know. Like I said, Conor's offered it for the bare knuckle. I'd have the bare knuckle. Yeah. Misfits have offered it for the boxing ring. There's another company called 1VSP.com, video sharing platform. There's a guy that owns that. He's offered a lot of money as well. And he said that we could have a profit share of the take from the social media views.
So it's down to you then to publicise it and get it.
I know John's going to get the bulk of the money. Like I said, he's the heavyweight champion of the world's dad,
yeah.
Right? He's a big name. I'm not a big name. But people want to see manners put on him, right? Even my wife, she said to me, When I was talking about the fight, she said, well, your wife's up. She's 58 years of age. You're talking about fighting, right? And I thought,
oh. I'm in trouble.
Lennox Lewis didn't frighten me. Mike Tyson didn't frighten me. She terrifies me. But the most powerful man that God ever created is Samson. And he was brought to his knees by Delilah. So what chance is me and Morsa's got when it comes to women, right? Okay. And when you look at some of the women that are fighting today and how well they're fighting, Jane Couch, their president. Then you've got Nicole Adams, the first female to win the Olympic gold medal. Katie Taylor, you know, Savannah Marshall. There's so many. Muhammad Ali's daughter, Leila Ali. Mm-hmm. You look at some of these women fighting, incredible fighters. And why shouldn't they be allowed to fight? Yeah, people criticise saying, oh, women shouldn't fight. Listen, the suffragettes did what they did, so women have equal rights. If women want to fight, let them fight. If women want to fly aeroplanes, let them fly aeroplanes. If women want to be plumbers, electricians, doctors, barristers, they're equal to us. Do you understand? They're equal to us. And let them do what they feel that they're capable of doing. And who are we to say that they can't? Male chauvinist. No, it's a man's sport. It's a man and woman's world. Do you understand? And I believe in equality. Mm-hmm. Right? I really do believe. Women fighting. Some of the best fights the last few years. Mm-hmm. Katie Taylor.
Katie Taylor's
incredible.
Yeah.
I know Katie from a little girl in a box with her dad, Peter Taylor. Good light everywhere Peter was. But there's some great female fighters out there. But with the John Fury carry on, John is saying, you know, different things. He's saying we're going to the barn and we'll fight in the barn. Yeah, we'll fight in the barn, no problem. I'll go to the barn, put the cameras in there, get the audience, see it. I'll be the man walking out of the barn. I know I will. I really do believe I've got that confidence I can beat him. You know, if he thought he could beat me, which he probably does anyway, he probably thinks he could beat me.
Think?
I think so. He's a fighter. He probably thinks he's got the better of me. You know, I wouldn't put the man down by saying no, he thinks I could beat him. You know?
But do you think he, like you say, he can be, like he's thinking on 58, can I get back into the ring? Do you think there's a...
Oh, he's a fit man.
Is it?
Oh, I trained with him. Is We're it? In the gym together.
Still, yeah.
I've watched him on the running machine. I've watched him lift weights. I've watched him pump his bike. He's a strong, fit man. He's got a good engine. That's where his son gets it from. Tyson has got an incredible engine for heavyweight. I watched his dad on the running machine. We trained together when I was on tour with Tyson. And I saw John on the running machine. He's got good stamina.
Yeah.
You know, I just hope that if the fight did happen, that I could get him out of there early. You know, because he'd be probably fitter than me. You know, but
yeah.
Who knows?
That'd be brilliant.
I think it'd be good if it was to happen, you know. Yeah. And I would like to think that when the fight's over, win, lose or draw, we dust ourselves down and we shake hands. And he'd say to me, I'm sorry that I insulted you, Joe, or Russell Crowe. You know, because it was an insult. There was no reason for him to say that. All he had to say was, Joe's my friend, right? That's all he had to say.
He's a good lad. He's a good man. He's just...
I raved about him and his family. I boast about my friendship with him and his family, you know. I think Tyson Fury is one incredible champion, right? Not because he became the heavyweight champion of the world, but because of what he overcome to become the heavyweight champion of the world. His mental illness, right? He suffered terrible, right? And he opened the floodgates for people to come forward and say they're suffering. Don't suffer in silence. One of my agents, a guy called Dave Mariner, him and his business partner, Pete, They have a business, a charitable business called Unmasked Mental Health, right? And the reason they call it Unmasked Mental Health is because a lot of tough men and women, they don't want to talk about suffering. So with the Unmasked Mental Health, you will keep your anonymity and ask for help. Do you understand? And say, I'm suffering. Don't suffer in silence. We've just lost one of the British greatest world champions ever, Ricky Hatton, through his suffering. He's out of his pain now. God rest him. He's in heaven. An incredible human being, an incredible champion. But he was tormented with his mental health issues. And he's out of his pain. Like I said, God rest the man. But Tyson Fury, by saying what he said, that he suffered with mental health and is still suffering with mental health.
He's the man on the planet.
Heavyweight champion of the world. You know, if he can say that he's suffering, why can't me immortals say it, you know? So he has brought to the forefront people that would not necessarily talk about it. Soldiers, policemen, tough men and women, you know, they're able to talk now and get help because Tyson Fury has said it.
Set a precedent.
Yes. So I admire that man, not just as the heavyweight champion of the world, not for a man that has had to overcome the stigma of being a traveller, you know. He's overcome mental health issues to achieve the greatness that he's achieved. He's immortalised as the heavyweight champion of the world and an incredible heavyweight champion of the world. Yes, he's lost twice to Usyk, who's another exceptional fighter, an incredible champion, cruiserweight champion of the world, and now the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. He's beaten everything put in front of him. But I do believe that there's a third fight there. And I do believe people probably think I'm mad. I think if Tyson was to make Usyk fight, like Chisora made him fight and Bellew made him fight, he's not comfortable fighting. He's comfortable boxing. You know, he's an incredible boxer. He's got incredible hand speed. He's a southpaw. I lost twice the southpaws. John Fury is a southpaw. So hopefully third time lucky for me of being able to fight. But I do believe that if Tyson was to put it on Usyk and make him fight in the corners, not let him move around the ring because he's faster than Tyson, which is unusual because Tyson's such a fast heavyweight. But Usyk is just an exceptional mobile fighter. He's got movement, hand speed. And you don't fight to that man's attributes. You don't fight to his ability. You bring him into the uncomfortable zone. You don't fight him in the comfort zone. You bring him out of that zone. So you don't make him box. You make him fight. Now, Tyson's had 24 rounds with him, two 12-round fights. Anthony Joshua's had two 12-round fights with him. And both of them, Tyson and Anthony, tried to box with the better boxer. Derek Chisora made him fight. An old warrior like Derek, an old, tough, hard man. And if you look at Usyk's face after that fight, his face was busted up. Tony Bellew, a man that had been in some incredible fights as a cruiserweight and as heavyweight, he made him fight. You know, he hurt him as well, but he unfortunately ran out of steam, I think round seven or round eight. But he took Usyk into the trenches, and that's what you've got to do. You've got to bring him into the trenches. And I do believe that if Tyson was to get into the shape that he got into when he fought Wilder, because when he got put down in that fight with Wilder, the first fight, he got up, was it the last round? And he was able to dance because of his fitness. You know, he didn't hold on, he danced, he moved. When he got put down by a man that had knocked out more or less everyone that he'd fought, one fighter, then Stavernet on the distance with him, and then he stopped Stavernet in the rematch in the first round. He knocked everybody out. And if you look at when Wilder hit Fury and Fury fell to the ground, he was unconscious. His eyes were closed. He was lying there. And Wilder was dancing. He was dancing because he knew the punch had connected well. He knew the impact of the punch. He'd done it to so many previous opponents. And he was dancing. You could see the joy in his face. Then you see him look as Fury rises to his feet.
The Tycho and it had
yes. He rose to his feet. And Wilder was so shocked. But that shows you the heart of the warrior. But not just the heart, the fitness, right? Because he was in the later rounds, the last round, I think it might have been, and he got up and he's got a supreme engine. So he can fight for 12 rounds, you know. And if he gets into the rematch, the third fight with Usyk, and gets himself into the best shape that he can get into, like he was in when he fought Wilder, and makes Usyk fight, not box, fight, I think he's got a great chance. Right, they say a fight is remembered for his last fight, and I would hate Fury to be remembered for his last fight as a lost Usyk. I would love him to come back and win and be remembered for his last fight as a victory. Because I tell you about my last fight, a Birmingham legend as well, that I boxed. When I retired from boxing, first time round, I was in a bad car crash and I had to retire from boxing. And I'd been in a good fight. I got stopped in the fifth round with cuts. I got 64 stitches after the fight. I was winning the fight. And I got stopped. My corner man at the time, Mr. Eastwood's corner men, they wanted to retire me. They said, you're badly cut. Like I said earlier, the fighter's the last man to know he's beat, right? And I'm saying, no, I'm fighting. The referee at the time was a man called Fred Teeth. He'd got the Olympic silver medal in 1956 for Ireland. And he was a family friend. And he's over with my corner men saying, we've got to stop the fight, Joe. You're cut to the bone. I'm pleading with the referee. I'm winning the fight. I was against Darren O'Brien. I'm winning. Please don't stop the fight. I can see. I can see. And he said, Joe, we can see the bone in your eye. You're cut. That was cut across both eyes. I've had the scar tissue cut away recently, my wife, because my skin was hanging down over my eye. It looked really bad. My wife organised it for me to get the scar tissue cut away because it looked like I had a droopy eye. So, but it was, I've had a lot of scar tissue cuts from fights. So they said, Joe, we can see the bone. It was cut across the cheek, across the top of the eye, down the side of the eye. I got 64 stitches after the fight. But I was stopped in the fifth round and I was involved in a bad car crash that same night. Shattered my shoulder, shattered my jaw, shattered my knee, and had several weeks in hospital. So not only had I got the cuts and the stitches from the fight, I'd badly wounded in a car accident. So my boxing career finished and I was out of the ring for 12 years. Anyway, I made a comeback after 12 years out of the ring because I was broke and I needed some quick money. And I got a fight. There was a big write-up in the boxing news. It said, George Foreman makes the comeback after 12 years, after 10 years. Big Joe Egan makes the comeback after 12 years. So they get mentioned in the same paragraph as George Foreman, one of the greatest heavyweight champions of all time. George Foreman makes the comeback after 10 years. Big Joe Egan makes the comeback after 12 years. I was buzzing to be mentioned in that paragraph with his name. Anyway, I got the fight. A friend of mine from Birmingham, a guy called Mark Williams, a legendary football Birmingham City fan, works with a Jaguar. Great professional fighter. I got Mark ready for two of his wins. He boxed on David Starry's bill in Ipswich and he boxed on Julius Francis's bill in London. And I trained with Mark and Flex Fitness in Digbeth. We'd sparred together many times. And Mark's
good matchup.
Mark's nickname is Smiley. He's a happy guy, but he's a hard case. Right, he's a great guy. And he hadn't boxed for 2.5 years. I hadn't boxed for 12 years. So I said to Mark, I said, listen, I need the money. Do you fancy having a fight? We'd sparred together many times. You know, we'd had some good sparring sessions. So Mark said, yeah, okay, we'll have a fight. So the promoter in Ireland, he was from Dublin, but lived in America. He put the bill on. The top of the bill was John O'Brien, the Thunderbolt. He's a great fighter. He's retired now to Lanzarote. He's got a gym out in Lanzarote. He's training fighters. He's top of the bill. Brendan Ingle of the Nasir Muhammad fame, a Dublin man. He's from Ringsend in Dublin, where I'm from. He had a fighter on the bill. There was a few other good fighters on the bill. So me and Mark were on the bill and were boxing. And I hadn't fought for 12 years, like I said. Mark was a lot sharper than me. So for the first two rounds, Mark's moving, hitting me from all angles, right? And I've gone back to my corner after round two. And my corner man, give me a slap. Wake up! Like I wasn't being hit enough by Mark. My corner man's giving me a slap. He said, he's punching lumps out of you. Wake up, will you? I was a bit rusty, right? A lot rusty.
Yeah,
right?
12 years. A bit rust on that.
Well, the thing is, sparring is helping you prepare. But there's nothing like the fight itself.
Match fitness.
Yeah. And after round two, getting a slap in the face to wake up, I've gone out for round three and I got into the fight. So Mark won round one and two. I've won round three and four. But at the end of round four, he was moving along the ropes to get out of the corner. And I pushed him back into the corner. But as I pushed him back into the corner, his shoulder dislocated. And his arm fell by his side. So he's gone back after round four with a dislocated shoulder, right? But he came out for round five with his arm hanging. That's the warrior in us. Do you understand? That's fact. I'm not making this up.
Why?
There was a fight a lot of years ago, Danny Williams against Mark Sprott. And not against Michael Sprott, Mark... I'm blank today with the names. Danny Williams, anyway. He dislocated his shoulder. And in the 10th round, he won the fight, his British title fight, with a dislocated shoulder. And Mark's come out for round five with his arm hanging, tried to fight with one arm. Wow. It's hard enough to fight with two arms.
Yeah.
You know, but he's still trying to fight. He's trying to, you know. The referee stopped the fight in round five. and I got the win. Probably wasn't the best way to win because the man had been wounded with a dislocated shoulder, but it was a win. And I was so happy to have got the win. Me and Mark are great friends, you know, I have great respect for him. And I've gone away, spoke to Brendan Ingle. And I said, how did I look, Brendan? A bit rusty. He said, but there's still a little bit left in the tank. He said, you got a couple of fights left in you. So I said, okay. Because in Dublin, we had to fight in Dublin.
Yeah.
You get the truth. If there was nothing there, people would say to me, Joe, there's nothing left.
Leave it.
Call it a day. It's over.
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
Right? Your mind sometimes can write the check that your body can't cash. Right? In my mind, I'm still 21. I'm still got it.
Yeah.
Because in your mind.
I'm still signed.
Yeah. But your body hasn't got it anymore, yeah. You know? Like I said, your mind writes a check that your body can't cash.
Yeah.
Right? But Brendan said to me, a bit rusty, but a bit left in the tank. My old trainer, Tony Mann, who'd done my corner for me, was my amateur trainer, said the same. Bit left in the tank, Joe, you know? You might have a couple of fights left in you.
You're like, I'll take it.
So I'm hearing this, right? I knew I'd been hurt by Mark, but I'm hearing these compliments, right? So I thought, I'm going to have another fight, right? Buzzing. I'm going to have another fight. I'm training for another fight. I'm with one of my best friends who I trained with many, many, many times, Steve Dawson, good light heavyweight. We'd worked the door together. We'd sparred many, many times. So I'm staying in his house in Dublin, getting ready to fight again. And we're walking out the front door, and his little boy, Tristan, where are you going, Big Joe? I said, me and your daddy are going to box, Tristan. Who's the toughest, you or my daddy? So I said, your dad's the toughest man on the planet, Tristan. In every boy's eyes, his dad's the toughest man on the planet, you know?
Yeah.
So we've gone sparring, headgear on, big gloves. I've ducked down. He's caught me. Split the eye wide open. Ripped to the bone. And I felt the blood running down my face. It wasn't even a good punch, Kevin. It wasn't a good punch, but I ducked into it wrong. Caught me on the bone, ripped the eye wide open. And I knew when the blood was gushing down my face, and it was over. I knew it was over. I knew as that punch ripped my eye open, I knew it's over. I went to the hospital, got the stitches all in my face, but I knew then it was over. I went back to Steve's house, and his little boy Tristan, looking at my face swollen and stitched up, he said, what happened, Big Joe? I said, oh, your daddy caught me with a punch when we were sparring. He said he was the toughest man on the planet. Rubbing salt into a wound, you know. But I retired on a win, Kevin, you know. And that was, to me, was my moral victory. I retired on a win, you know. I didn't want to box again after that, you know. But when, getting back to Fury, when he said the insults to Jake Paul and to KSI, he said to KSI, I'll bend you over the table and I'll bomb you. It's on the internet. And he said to Jake Paul, I'll rape your missus. Such insults, horrible things to say. And my wife said to me, who didn't want me to fight? She said, you put manners on that man. So that was, to me, was the full steam ahead, yeah, the green light, you know. So if I do have to fight again, like I'd like to fight again, I would like to end my career on another win, like I won against Mark. Mm. And that was a good fight, me and Mark, you know.
So I could speak to you all night and all that. Oh, but just finally, tell me a little bit about the charity work that you're now doing.
I do lots of charity work, yeah. You know, I'm very proud to be asked, you know. I work a lot. I do a lot for Help the Heroes, Holidays for Heroes, ex-British soldiers that are suffering, mental health, homelessness, you know. So I do a lot with that. I do a lot with the Unmasked Mental Health with Dave Mariner and Pete. I do a lot with the you see, but this is the T-shirt of training.
Yeah.
You know. The knife crime at the moment is an epidemic around the UK. Had a friend of mine, ex-military, Simon Jones, sadly, tragically, stabbed to death down Derby for his van. Ex-Falklands veteran, 14 years, RAF regiment. A gang of thugs, a gang of scum, tried to steal his van. And they stabbed him to death on a car park in Derby for his Volkswagen van. And I've lost a few friends to knife crime, you know. And it's an epidemic at the moment, you know. There's a lot of it around the UK. I'm doing a show on the 28th of November in Corby. Knives down, gloves up, you know. We were trying the streets of the UK. Very violent at the moment. And, you know, the police are under a lot of pressure, Kevin. Under a lot of pressure. I don't understand how the government is cutting down the numbers of police, closing down police stations. It's not like the streets are safe.
Mm.
The streets are dangerous. You know, and there should be more police patrolling the streets. And with the knife crime in particular, there's so much of it.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of anti-knife crime. I do a lot of anti-bullying. You know, I lecture in schools. And I do think that the boxing gyms, the youth clubs, are safe havens for kids.
I was about to say that to you, yeah. It's, we've had a few people on here, Ginge from Shard End, that happened to go viral for something, but he's turned that around now to start being an ambassador for training gyms, and John Pegg's been on. And
John's a great guy. And just, Ginge is a great guy as well. Yeah, I met him there recently at a boxing show. He's friends with my nephew Tom.
Yeah.
And Ginge's had a few boxing matches. He puts the shows on, you know, same as John Pegg. They put the shows on.
Getting the kids to come in and do something that's, get them off the streets for a start, but then instilling that discipline and saying, but we were
well, the camaraderie
thing, it's the gone, gym. That's gone, hasn't it?
The camaraderie in the gym, the camaraderie in the youth clubs, you know, and are safe havens.
Yeah.
Because if you can, like we said earlier on, get your home and close that front door, that used to be a safe haven, you know. But now with the internet and mobile phones and that, people are getting bullied, even behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
But when you go to a boxing gym, when you go to a youth club, the safety in numbers of good people, you know, and 9 times out of 10, maybe I'm biased being an ex-boxer, but 9 times out of 10, the unity in the boxing gym is incredible. The camaraderie in the boxing gym is incredible. The friendship in the boxing gym.
And it's a family for people who might not necessarily have that family unit.
You know, so I would encourage, you know, there's other sports as well. Yeah. There's great camaraderie in martial arts. There's great camaraderie in the football and different sports. But unity, do you understand? And united we stand, divided we fall. You know, and I do believe that we do need to support one another in this time with the streets being so violent. You know, people have to come together and try and stop this, you know, because it's horrible when you see family suffering with a child being stabbed to death. And that's what's happening now. Kids are getting stabbed to death.
Literally.
12, 11, 13, 15 young children haven't even lived the life, you know, and their lives are being took, you know, and the knock-on effect of the family suffering, the friends suffering, It's horrific, you know. So I do try and listen, if what I do helps save one life, it's a success. You know, I go on a lecture, I go and meet people, and try to discourage violence. You know, I've lived a violent life. You know, I've stood on doors. I left school, as I said earlier on. 40, I was on the doors, and I was at 15. So I've been involved in a lot of fights, you know, punch-ups.
But that lived experience, haven't
you? Yeah, you know, I've been shot twice. I've been stabbed many times, mm-hmm. you know. So I've lived, I've had run-ins with the Grim Reaper. I've been on the life support machine. I was 5 days on a life support machine, 3 days in a coma. So I've had run-ins with the Grim Reaper. He's come for me on a few occasions, but I've managed to fight him off. I don't want to go yet. I want to go to heaven. I believe in heaven. I pray every day. You know, I want to go to heaven, but I'm not in a hurry to get there, John. I want to get there, Kevin. You know, but I'm not in a hurry to get. Not in a hurry to get there. But I pray every day. I believe in the power of prayer, Kevin. I really do. You know, I don't try to force my beliefs onto people. You know, I believe there's one God. Call him Allah. Call him Buddha. Call him God. As long as you respect him in the right way, respect yourself and respect others, and pray every day. You know, I do say to people, every day is a gift from God. That's why it's called the present. Tomorrow's not promised to anybody. Every day is the gift from God. You know, live your life to the best you can, and be kind. What we spoke about earlier on, be kind to one another. You know, and I hope that this knife crime epidemic stops. Shouldn't happen. You know, and if my little bit can help save a life, then it's a success, you know?
Yeah.
Anything else you want to talk about? Oh, I called you John earlier on.
It's been a pleasure. I can talk to you all night, but yeah, thanks.
Yeah, pleasure.